Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, listeners. Oh, get those mics in order. This is Annie for Solidarity Breakfast, and we've got a full house here today. We've got Tamaya, we've got Anila, and we've got Matt. Matt's going to be a bigger voice for Solidarity Breakfast over the next 4 weeks because, of course, Tobias going a slacker. He's a slacker. He's going on a holiday.
Such a slacker to
me. That's right. It's so funny. Everyone's laughing because he's so If there was a dictionary definition of working really hard, that would be Tobias.
Oh, thanks, guys. It means a lot.
And you've earned your holiday.
Yeah, you have.
And you're filling out your notebook at the moment of all the activities.
It's enclosing around the specified time of the holiday, but it coincides with a brisk morning.
Yes, that's
how
right.
It fell up in Reservoir, right, Matt?
It was so foggy today.
Yeah.
I could hardly see the nose in front of my face. So
Oh, there's something nice about that, though. It's a bit like you're in a world of glass almost when you've got fog like that because it's got sort of presence.
You know, it's so interesting the difference in worldviews that people bring to these experiences because all I think about when it's foggy is, wow, my hair's going to get really frizzy.
Yeah, mine too.
I get really spooked. I think it's really exciting.
I feel special.
Yeah, I feel like there's interesting things behind walls and around corners and stuff like that. And we're just waiting to be shared with. I think it's really exciting.
I went out last night and when I went into the venue, I was going to see a band called Way Dynamic, great band and great support acts. But when I went into the venue, not a bit of fog in sight. And as I emerged, to use a word you might like, Annie, everything was blanketed in fog and it was a pretty intense vibe. I agree. It feels pretty magical.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. Anyway, we've got news to be talked about, lots of news. Anybody want to start?
I mean, it was interesting the conversation we were having about, you know, what is terrorism and what isn't. I've just signed up to a new uni for the next... Yeah, and I took a class that talks about this. When is terrorism terrorism and when is it called something else? And we saw that in the reporting for Belfast and the response that was talked about with the Manchester police in response to an artist pro-Palestine work who you were saying that she got raided?
Yeah, she got raided. She's an artist. And in fact, there's the thing that gets me is that there's now a chuffed.org call out for funds because she's been charged. Now, this is a person who is an artist. She's put out a comic book, a pro-Palestinian comic book. She's spoken at rallies. Young woman. She's got three children. One's 11. One's the youngest is 4. 7 a.m. and in the morning, a full complement of armed police raided her house in Manchester and for apparently being... what she's been charged with is... let's see what it is. They're terrorism charges. She's been charged with terrorism and...
Yeah, Annie, I've just looked up the artist's Chuffed account. It's Aisha Fazel. She's just given an update. She's actually saying she's had her bank account shut down. And she's not received any satisfactory response with her bank, which is Halifax Bank. So, yeah, this is really, really disturbing. And this is in the context of... it says here that the raid took place on the 22nd of January 2025, as you mentioned off air, Annie, at the break of dawn, and she has young children who were off school that week. And 15 officers, and most of them were armed, had stormed through her home. So this is really disturbing. On top of the news we heard this week of the 50-year prison sentences that were given to those activists that were protesting against the, what's going on with the anti-immigration
In the US.
Yeah.
They were given 50 years prison sentence, one of them for who actually left when...
when she was asked to.
Yeah, when she was asked to. It's definitely putting out... it's dog whistling. What they're doing is dog whistling. I mean, the woman in Manchester was accused of extreme Islamic belief. And she's been charged. And this was based on anti-terrorism units being basically rung up on a ongoing basis by Zionist aligned voices, dobbing her in as a terrorist threat.
But ironically, it is literally the type of suppression of people's civil rights that does lead to violent extremism. Like, I think the consistent lesson from the last 200 years of history is that when you remove a population's ability to peacefully meet their community's needs for things like security and basic human rights like food and shelter, people do have to rely on violent means of getting those needs met. If you're putting populations in jail for 50 years for protesting.
Yeah.
How do you think that's going to go?
Well, there's nothing to lose.
Exactly.
Well, so one is assuming that is the strategy that is being put down by maybe the end game is something that the right wing oligarchs are keen for, because we've seen in Belfast the attack on people of colour. Settled there with, burning of their houses and things of that nature. Interesting that it's considered to be, it was put forward by the rioters that it was all about a nationalistic Irish response. But of course, it was by people who had done the same thing in the 70s to Catholic Irish people to remove them from exactly the same area. And these same people are the people who like to see themselves as British, not as Irish. So the ingenuousness of it is breathtaking, as well as contrived, because as the money trail goes through, it's actually got American fingerprints all over this high-octane anti... It's just an attack on...
I mean, I think they should be called pogroms.
That's exactly what it is. It's exactly the same kind of approach that was done in Europe, in various parts of Europe, and not just Russia. A range of places attack Jewish people in pogroms.
And if you've got a situation where you've got young children having to be hidden from violent...
Extremists,
yeah. Obviously, that isn't about, protecting your national identity.
And just getting back to the news of these 50-year prison sentences against these activists who were protesting against the harsh, totalitarian, anti-immigration stance in Trump, it comes down to this labelling of groups. So, like, they label it Antifa, but it's Antifa is not... a broad organization. It's just
it's a concept.
It's a concept. Yeah. And in fact, I'm just reading, just looking through online. This is on the PBS website about this coverage of these people who got the 50-year sentences. They actually did not say they were members of Antifa. They're actually members of a book reading group.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
But this mystification of terms and places and historical moments is capitalized on by people like, I love what you've written in the notes here, right-wing knob. Tommy Robinson, but we know his name's not Tommy Robinson. His name's actually Stephen Lennox. So I think we should start calling him by his real name, Stephen Christopher Yaxley Lennon, who's a British far-right politician who was previously involved before co-founding the English Defence League, which is a well-reported-on Zionist project. He was part of the British National Party, which famously had no luck in the polls and so instead focused on street marches and mobilising large amounts of people, creating the Combat 18 paramilitary, which is
a fear and loathing, effectively. And it's interesting you should bring that up, because George Mobiot, English commentator, has pointed out in his latest newsletter that, which he calls, it's real and it's the exact opposite of what the far right says it is. What is two-tiered justice? He talks about the notion that what's going on in the race riots that happened in Belfast and other types of things that have been stirred up are actually terrorism, but that the state refuses to actually name right-wing attacks on the population as terrorism, just as the using the anti-terror squad on an artist and her family is making people believe that the state and the government are actually aligned with the right wing.
I mean, what
am I wrong there?
Well, what happened in New South Wales when the president of Israel,
President Herzog's visit,
and was that not terrorism?
On another, I don't know if you've noticed, but the use of AI, not only the snuffling up of public land for data centres all around Melbourne in Footscray and ringing the entire place, which is almost, you'd have to say, a Ponzi scheme of AI delight, believing that everything is going to be in the hands of oligarchs running AI, and the government's giving over all our assets, our water and in a dry land to
creating a ring of fire.
One of the most fascinating things, horrifying things, is the thing about the robot drones. Now, if you're a reader and you're old like me, you would have read Philip K. Dick's stories about the automated. I mean, this is like, it's like they're taking their they've got a list, you know, a checklist, and it's a Philip K. Dick checklist of the things that they want to create. And so you would have heard about the robot drones in the Ukraine David Shoebridge put out a piece which he describes it so perfectly that I thought it would be worthwhile allowing the great man speak.
We need to ban killer robots, and we need a global treaty to do it urgently. We have just had the first confirmation that a fully autonomous AI drone has killed humans. The details are now becoming clearer. In parts of the Ukraine battlefront, drones with no human oversight were instructed to kill every human in a given area, and they did. Meaningful human control is necessary across technology, but it's especially essential when we're talking about issues of war, the deliberate infliction of pain and harm and death. Of course, we need human oversight. We are seeing the rise of AI warfare across the world. The US Department of War used Elon Musk's AI some 2,000 times in the initial targeting in Iran. And life and death decisions, mostly death decisions, are being made by AI in places like Gaza and Lebanon and Iran thousands and thousands of times. Humans must take responsibility for the wars they start and for the killing that is a part of a war. We cannot contract this out. In fact, it is incredibly dangerous to contract this out to algorithms and AI. For years, human rights groups have been campaigning for a treaty to ban killer robots, and the time is now. This is no longer some kind of sci-fi movie. This is a horrifying dystopia that's happening around us. We need a treaty to ban killer robots.
Now, that's David Shoebridge. Now, he's a senator for the Greens in New South Wales. Now, it would appear that the Greens are the only people who are being sensible about this. Why is that so?
Yeah, also in the New South Wales, we can remember a story we reported on previously. In Maree, the police have started using drones to catch people in a First Nations dense community around there in Maree.
Oh my God.
And they've gone out to do, you know, assist police and searches and all these sort of terms. So, I mean,
why do you think it's all right?
Mm.
I mean, really? I mean, you really have to ask yourself, why do you think that having these people who are proving themselves to be unconscionable, having unlimited levels of power over everything, is a good idea? It's quite bizarre, quite bizarre.
On that note, I think the other really big piece of news that's been developing in the last couple of weeks is Elon Musk becoming a trillionaire, which you guys might have discussed on the show last week. But I heard something like truly...
No, we chose not to.
I think this needs to be said, this piece of information I've picked up this week that was like bone chilling. Amazon's CEO, Jeff Bezos, is closer in wealth to the average person than he is to Elon Musk. That's how vast the difference is between a billionaire and a trillionaire.
Wow.
That's just ridiculous, isn't it? And also that is actually a security risk to the entire human project, having someone that wealthy. In fact, I know we wouldn't normally do this, but I've got to play this song because that's just the perfect... There is a language warning.
Elon Musk is a fuck of a man. Just look at his rich kid face. Well, I'd like to make his dream come true and shoot him into outer space. Wasn't it Vladimir Lenin who said there ain't no competition? Once the rich buy up all the capital, they buy the law and the politicians. He's not an inventor,
no,
he's an investor,
oh.
And if you don't lance them, they start to fester.
Gross.
So if you're running around in a panic and you're wondering who you can trust, whether it's socialism or barbarism, it's the people or Elon Musk.
Happy birthday, Rosa Luxemburg!
Elon Musk is a husk of a man, born on an emerald mine. He's a big bootlicking grifter with a mediocre mind. And rich guys don't do shit. He's not an inventor,
oh.
He's an investor,
oh.
And if you don't lance them, soon they start to fester.
Gross.
So if you're running around in a panic and you're wondering who you can trust, whether it's socialism or barbarism, it's the people or Elon Musk. I said it's socialism or barbarism, it's the people or Elon Musk. Your choice.
So we want to support whatever actions are going on by local communities to close down arms factories, whether it's Boeing, Northrop Grumman, BAE Systems, Thales, you name it. There's a lot of places throughout this continent, EOS, which people should be closing down, demanding their money, which they may have in their superannuation funds, are no longer invested in profiting from genocide. People need to take action for boycott. Go to the BDS movement website, boycotts, divestment, sanctions, and take actions on land, sea and air to break this illegal blockade and stand with our Palestinian siblings.
More strength to your arm, James. Thanks for talking to us this morning.
Hey, absolutely honoured to be on beautiful community radio. Love you all at 3CR.
That's right. That was one of our interviewees a couple of weeks ago. And we're moving on to on Solidarity Breakfast this morning to Voices for Palestine. What have we got, Tobias? It's a story that just keeps giving.
Yeah, it's a this is a article that was written on Electronic Intifada by Lubna Ahmed Abu Sita, who writes about just her day. I just saw it. It was from a little bit like from earlier in the year, but I think it's important to highlight the reality of what's going on.
Elegance in Gaza is a luxury, and most of the time, it's impossible to attain. Today, I am setting out from Khan Yunis in southern Gaza to meet my graduate advisor in Deir al-Balah at Al-Aqsa University's temporary headquarters to submit my master's thesis plan, and I want to look elegant. I want to meet him as a university student, as I see this meeting as a step towards repairing what has been broken in my life. The daily routines, the disappeared infrastructure, the destroyed university life. What someone outside of Gaza might take for granted, putting on a nice outfit and looking neat, is not taken for granted here. We wash clothes by hand. We carry jugs of water for this task and save money for soap. Washing clothes by hand takes hours. Then, to iron, we must have a battery charged and ready. Maintaining one's physical appearance is an exhausting daily task with many pre-planned steps. But today I feel ready, and I start the day full of energy. At our house in Khan Yunis, where I am from and where I have lived for all my life, I put on my best clothing, a light beige coat and a checkered scarf, and I set off for Deir al-Balah. The moment I step onto Al-Bar Street, I am hit by reality. The streets of Gaza are a shock to the senses. The asphalt of the road is gone. The pavement of a sidewalk is not pavement. It is dirt and debris, a mix of shards of concrete, trash, and other various bits of rubble. Mountains of rubble are on either side of the former street. I play hopscotch among the debris, carefully picking where to place my feet to avoid sinking into puddles. It is a desperate struggle to keep my outfit clean, to maintain the idea of myself that I had built up while getting dressed. Then there is fear. Since the beginning of the war, the mere thought of going out alone has terrified me, the prospect of being killed by an Israeli attack and nobody finding my body for days. When I hear the drones, I imagine they are watching the person right next to me, waiting to strike. It is a recurring nightmare that I go north to Gaza City. Israel will again cut off the north from the south and I will be trapped there, away from my family. I wait for a car to pick me up. I see what has now become a common sight, a trailer or akala hitched behind a car, transporting people who must grip the edges of the trailer to not fall out. I watch as their bodies jerk and jolt over the shock of the bumps in the road. Every car that passes is a mechanical miracle, dilapidated, broken, and running by sheer luck. Most of Gaza's cars have been destroyed by Israeli attacks, and it's more common to see cars burned up, discarded, or stacked than running on the roads. The smell in the air is cooking oil, which is mixed with gasoline to get a little more mileage in a car, and I choke a little as I breathe it in. After a full hour of waiting amid the swirls of dust, I feel the elegance from before slip away. I finally manage to get into the back seat of a packed Skoda car that is also hauling a trailer with even more passengers. Next to me is a woman in her 60s whose 13-year-old granddaughter has moved onto her lap to make room for me. On the other side of her is a medical student whispering into her phone, "I will send the report as soon as I reach the hospital. I'm still on the road." Suddenly the car stops and a woman in her 40s, her face drenched in sweat and anxiety, pleads, "Let me sit with you. My mother is waiting for me at the hospital." We somehow manage to squeeze her into the back seat, so now five of us are crammed in there. I look out the window behind her and see hundreds of people on the road waiting for a car, with looks of despair on their faces. Every time the car stops, people peer inside, note that it's full, and then continue to wait for a ride. The car struggles to get its start again, weighed down by the many passengers. We finally reach Al-Aqsa Junction, the gathering point for cars travelling between Khan Yunis and Deir al-Balah. In the past, a taxi could have taken you the full way, but now the ride is split up between multiple taxis or whatever kind of transport you can find. At the junction, I see donkeys and horses pulling carts, and tents packed into any open space available. This area used to feel a little more rural, with views of green space and agricultural lands. But because Salah al-Din Road is now in a, quote, yellow zone and is off limits, transport hubs have moved elsewhere, to places like this, where thousands of people converge daily to try and get around Gaza. I walk through the carts and the market stalls and I find the woman whose mother is at the hospital in another car. I take the seat next to her and she tells me that her mother has cancer and is undergoing chemotherapy. She says that in the past, hospitals would have provided transport to family members to accompany the patients, but that has now stopped. Our journey continues and I take in what I see along the road. I see a boy, barely 12, pulling a wooden cart with worn-out wheels through the sand. In the back of the cart is a black water tank, and he shouts at the top of his lungs, "Water! Who wants to buy water?" I watch him and I want to scream. Why must this child live like this? Moments later, I see another child, no older than 10, inside a dilapidated blue car moving at slow speed. The vehicle has been stripped of its bumpers and glass windows. Nylon and tape hold it together. Then I see a rusted red three-wheeled tuk-tuk swaying from side to side with no roof. Children cling to its outer edges. I look at the small hands gripping the metal. In another car besides the driver on the passenger seat is a large gas cylinder, strapped in with an iron chain. I think, this is a ticking time bomb, and I turn away. I pull my thesis work out of my bag and I try to read through it. My master's degree is in geography and my thesis is about map-making skills among Gaza's youth. I find it hard to focus though and I close my eyes for the rest of the journey. I had left home at 8 a.m. and it's nearing noon when I arrive in Deir al-Balah. I take my wet wipes out of my bag and clean my shoes and scarf and try to regain composure. But after a 4-hour trip, it's difficult. As I tried to find my professor, I think of Dr. Wissam Issa, the head of the geography department at Al-Aqsa University. He was martyred in December 2023. I miss Dr. Wissam. He would have been the one to guide me through my thesis. I also think of my friend Shard, another geography master's student in my class. She was martyred with a family a year and a half ago. The meeting with my advisor is short, about an hour. We discuss the challenges ahead of us, studying geography and technology with limited resources and a lack of reliable access to the internet or even electricity. Around 2 p.m., I begin the journey back to Khan Yunis to make sure I can get back before sunset. Every step I take towards earning this degree, I now see as a tribute to those we have lost.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
This is Birrigan from Bulagan, coming live from the occupied territories of Gumbengi country Nambucca Heads, New South Wales. You're listening to 3CR Radical Radio.
And you're on 3CR, yeah, with Dabaya, Anila, Matt and Annie on Solidarity Breakfast on this chilly Saturday morning. And hello to you guys who are listening to us by podcast. We don't forget you.
This might be a good time to do some radiothon reminders.
Oh, that's right. We haven't reached our target. We don't feel loved.
Show us true. Some love, listeners. Show us some yeah. love.
Come on.
Yeah, exactly. Show us some love. We get up early in the morning. We try to entertain you.
Isn't
but
that
also
enough?
We bring you more than entertainment. We bring you news that no one else brings you. Opinions, great pieces of reading like the one that Anila just did. And every dollar over $2 is tax deductible and doesn't go to the Australian war machine sending drones and weapons of death overseas.
Yeah.
Instead comes into the coffers of 3CR and makes sure that plenty of programs have a space on the air.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you've got to admit that a community radio station that's lasted for 50 years is something to be celebrated. That is a human endeavour that has worked in a positive framework for 50 years consistently. Oh, and I should remind you that you're invited to our birthday party on the July the 4th at the Collingwood Town Hall, because as a listener, we honour you. We would like you to come. It starts at 11 a.m. and it goes till about 4, I think. Lots of things happening, and in fact you could be interviewed and you can give your views about why it was such a wonderful thing. What I notice is that people have got short memories. They forget. And if you're accursed with a longer memory for things, you are surprised constantly that someone will forget that, for example, the Australian media outlets wouldn't let women on the air because their voices were too squeaky, apparently. Did you know that?
No, I do not know that, Annie. I'm really appalled yeah. to hear that. No, seriously, I am.
I know, yeah. it's wild.
Wait till you find out that they couldn't open their own bank accounts, Matthew.
I knew about that. I knew about that.
No, it's shocking and it's kind yeah. of absurdity. I agree.
It's really yeah, absurd. Yeah.
The landscape before community radio was a very closed book, held tight in the fat fists of finance and government oppression. Not that it was dressed up as oppression. It was all nice and cool. Everybody in Menzies Land were happy. But actually, it's not true. Actually, there are lots of chinks in the armour of Menzies Land. And the flowering of the community radio sector wasn't even a sector. It was just a fight that people fought for the community to have a public voice and to have a wider view being presented to the general public rather than just a sterile belief structure that has been put forward as if everything is fine. Don't look now. Everything's fine. I mean, it's places like 3CR that maintained the rage regarding East Timor, which is now Timor-Leste. That was a closed book to the mainstream. It was all under control, even when the East Timorese were being starved. We, you know, oh no, it's okay, it's all right. And we're now at the moment witnessing the destruction of the West Papuans in exactly the same way. Have you heard a news item about West Sahara and how the Moroccans walked in and decided they wanted their land? Imperialism is everywhere.
I also think it's a really great time to be getting involved in supporting 3CR, particularly at this kind of political moment. We've got a very obvious breakdown of the status quo that's being felt across society, outside of the left. And this is the time that we need to stake our claim to being the leaders of those ideas and political movements that shape the future.
Yeah, positive futures.
Well, that's right, because 3CR, it's not something that you, if you don't just, if you, it just can support with money. If you don't have money, in fact, you can come and volunteer. You can be a part of it. You can be trained up how to do some radio programs. The breakfast teams always need committed people that want to make a change and do some own research. And there's plenty of programs here that are willing to take you as well. And it's a great way to be involved in a truly democratic organization that sees your fulfillment as a part of its main goals.
Yeah, they're well put. Well put.
I know it's a little bit asynchronous, but maybe it's a perfect time to go back in time to the S11 protests.
Okay, all right, let's go. Let me find it. There we go.
And it is this new democracy that is pluralistic, in which the local leads to change the global, because it's the only way the global can change. In which all who have been on the margins unleash their creative forces to create new freedoms for all in an inclusive way. That's the kind of threshold at which we are. And we will not be criminalized. We will not be terrorized. We will not be afraid. We will just enjoy and have fun in this new freedom movement in which we all are.
We've got environmentalists, we've got socialists, we've got feminists, we've got anarchists, we've got workers, we've got students, we've got women, we've got people from every different group imaginable, and a whole range of people who never have really worked together like this in the past. And if we take anything out of this, we really need to take together this spirit of working together, because we will not win this fight in one day, we won't even win it in 3 days, and we certainly won't win it in one country. And what we need to do is stand up together and have international solidarity and fight this fight in all countries of the world with all vulnerable and exploited people together.
And it's no more an altruistic. So, I mean, I had a conversation, a lot of people said, you know, Australia is a very comfortable society. A lot of people, you know, who are, you know, we're not poor, they're middle class, they have their homes, they have their cars, they have their TVs, and they're very happy, they're comfortable. Why the hell do they need to get involved in all these issues? Well, if you don't, you will be the next victim. So you don't have to fight for altruistic reasons anymore. It's for the fight of humanity and for your own humanity, for your own survival. So we don't have a choice as a civil society in the world but to fight and struggle.
Hugh Morgan, Western Mining Company, and all these people who are getting rich on uranium and exploitation of all Indigenous people's lands around Australia, you can forget that, because we're going to keep going. This is our life.
It is the corporation that has become obsolete. It is the corporation that serves as a fetter to humanity's movement to new and necessary social arrangements to achieve the most quintessentially human values of justice, equity, democracy, and to achieve a new equilibrium between our species and the rest of the planet.
According to them, we're all way behind, when the fact is, we know we're looking into the future and know the reality of the corporate mindset.
And create totally new institutions that do not have the baggage of illegitimacy, institutional failure, and Jurassic mindsets that attach to the IMF, WTO, and the World Bank. Indeed, I would contend that the focus of our efforts these days is not to try to reform the multilateral agencies, but to deepen the crisis of legitimacy of the whole system.
I think a lot of people are going to need a lot of support and debriefing time now, because I think a lot of people are quite shaken by what's happened, but I think that a lot of positive things will come out of it too.
This structure is unsustainable, it is unfair, and it thrives on inequality and inequity in all its forms. This structure kills people slowly, and daily people die many times in all societies and in all cultures to sustain it. Every day we rape the earth, and every day we rape the poor to sustain the few pockets of riches that we have. Can we really understand this, make the connections, and join the fight against this structure? Can we? I leave you with this question today.
I'm sure Melbourne will be remembered for the message that we are not terrorists. Defending our fundamental rights guaranteed by our constitutions is not terrorism, but the very foundation of democracy, and we are not going to give it up.
The compilation was produced in the studios of 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne by Rachel Maher and Juliet Fox. We'd like to thank all those people who contributed material to this compilation and all those who added their voice to the protest. Yeah.
G'day folks, the 3CR Gardening Show's annual radiothon is coming up soon. Sunday the 28th of June from 7:30 to 10 a.m, and we'd love you to be a part of it. This year's Gardening Show radiothon is extra special. 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. That's 5 decades of community radio, independent voices, and programs like ours that you simply won't find anywhere else. Community radio doesn't run itself. Your support during radiothon is what keeps the Gardening Show on air, paying for airtime, equipment, and everything that goes into bringing our program to you full of gardening goodness every week. Show your support. We've got some wonderful goodies up for grabs. Garden tours, quality tools, nursery vouchers, subscriptions, and much more. If you can't call in on the day, that's fine. You can make a tax-deductible donation online at 3cr.org.au. Every contribution makes a real difference. In 3CR's 50th year, there's never been a better time to stand behind the station and the shows that really matter to you, like The Gardening Show. The Gardening Show Radiothon is Sunday the 28th of June, 7:30 a.m. to 10 a.m, celebrating 50 years of 3CR goodness.
And you're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Tobiah and Anila and Matt. It's getting longer and longer. It's like the very hungry caterpillar. And we're going to go to a conversation that I had with he's one of the presidents of one of the elements of AEU. He's a teacher. He's an educator. It's Daryl Croker. You will remember, you guys, that 2 Fridays ago there was a massive rally of AEU Vic teachers and support staff, and they've been, this is about the second or third rally that they've had, and it's a really big thing because what happened was the AEU had a chat with the negotiated after the last big rally with the Education Minister Ben Carroll about their 35% increase in salary and reductions in class sizes, except and the reduction in administration duties that the teachers, etc., have to do. And they came back with an offer which was not what the membership wanted. The executive took it to the membership, and the membership declined. They decided against it. Now, this is a really big thing because the executive actually made noises to the government that they thought that, you know, the membership would accept it because they were given 28% over 4 years, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But I got the chance to talk to Daryl to find out a little bit more about why the membership weren't happy and what's going to happen next. And he also explains a little bit about how the union works. That's why I was a little bit of a stumbling a little bit over my words in regards to where Daryl fits, because he's an educator and he's the president of a section of the AEU that covers about 40 schools. I know, it sounds amazing. That as his that's his contribution, but I can't remember the name of what that role is called. So he tells us.
Daryl, one of the most interesting things leading up to the vote, the government offer to the AEU Victoria branch, was that before members were brought together to vote, a social media post was put out saying that, that there'd been an agreement, but this was before the members had actually voted. So that was pretty interesting, wasn't it? Because the executive was pretty confident.
Yeah, it was. I feel like there's problems with the language. It was touted as an in-principle agreement when it really was an offer from the government. We also had a lot of ALP members then went on social media and said that there's been an agreement between the union and the government, and there wasn't an agreement because members hadn't even voted yet.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because they really believe that the executive's response is overweening in relation to agreements of this sort, when in actual fact it's a membership organisation. It really showed them wrong-footed, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. I mean, and look, the votes was 58% nearly voted against the agreement, and we had 42% voted for. So it was really a democratic, our union is a democratic union, and members did have their say, and they came to that conclusion. Voting took place on a branch level. Every sub-branch got to vote.
Can you give me an idea of what were the reasons people were giving for not voting for this agreement?
Yeah, I think our expectations are fairly high, that teaching the last 5 years and also being an educator has become increasingly more difficult since COVID. And what we really were hoping for was a transformational agreement. So we wouldn't only just get a wage rise, but things in our workplaces would dramatically change. And that's what we were hoping for, and that's what the government didn't deliver. And therefore, I think that's what's really behind the rejection. So, for instance, many teachers wanted some relief for the workload we're under at the moment. We wanted maybe a reduction in class sizes or reduction in face-to-face teaching, or maybe some of the admin tasks that we're doing, but there'd be less of that. And the agreement didn't really deliver on that.
And I noticed when I was talking to people who were at the first rally, or the second rally, in fact, that the government has made these decisions where they're bringing more students with special needs into ordinary classrooms, but not actually providing any support structures for those students, which was causing some people quite a lot of grief.
Yeah, there's a lot of admin involved in that as well. So one of our claims we had in the log of claims was for every student that did have some special needs, that we'd have our classes reduced accordingly so we could deal with that. It's something that we really wanted some acknowledgement of as well. There's been a lot of students are funded, which is a good thing, but there's a lot of admin in schools that go to get that extra funding. You have to actually do a lot of work to get the extra funding.
And also I noticed that there was some discussion about the fact that educational support staff weren't included in the offer that the government put forward. Is that right?
No, it's not right. The contention there is that although teachers got a fairly clear wage rise, depending on the classification, between about 28% and 32% wage rise, yes, got a wage rise, but it wasn't a simple hourly rate wage rise. A lot of it was an allowance. The concern there was what would happen if that allowance was taken away by a future government. The other concern was if it's not an hourly rate, how does that affect more cumulative conditions, etc. So, you know, the ES wanted to be treated the same as teachers. If teachers got an hourly rate wage rise, then ES wanted the same.
Now that there's been a decision not to accept the offer, it appears that there's a variety of factions amongst the membership. Would that be fair to say?
Look, in any union, there's a variety of groups who have a variety of points of view. But I think that's a bit of a misnomer. I think most people voted against the agreement because they didn't like the agreement rather than being politically swayed by anyone. That's the way sort of I said, I know the media is trying to beat this issue up. But as I said, there's people who've got a right to have different points of view and different tactics and different strategies. But I think fundamentally, the government tried to lowball us and the membership rejected that.
Okay, so it's an interesting thing, the way the union is organised, having sub-branches as well as having what's called the Joint Primary and Secondary Council. Now, the Joint Primary and Secondary Council is going to meet again on the 17th of July, but there seems to be some discussion, or maybe I'm wrong, discussion about if there should be industrial action. They said that they wanted to survey the members instead of taking industrial action as a firm step forward in this.
Yeah. There's another missing thing you've missed. So our school is organised by sub-branches. Then your next level up is regions. So I'm the president of a region where we have 48 schools in the region that I'm in. Then we have the next layer up with state council, and then we have the state executive. There is going to be a survey of members, and it is quite a while to wait before they make a decision. I'm sort of confident, though, from recent statements that our union leadership have made, that there will probably be end up being a vote. Well, there'll probably end up being industrial action in term three, probably week three. That would be my guess, but we'll probably take some form of industrial action. I'm not sure of the scope of it, but reading between the lines, I think that's what will happen. Also, there's a lot of bans that are recommencing at a school level. So there'll be a ban on writing comments on reports. There'll be a ban on ALP members of parliament visiting schools. There'll be a ban on having two meetings a week. We'll go back to having only one meeting after classes a week. There'll be more scope to take some stop work action at a school level as well. So this all happened since day one. So what the discussion really is about is that the timing of a strike and who will that involve? Will it be a region by region level or will it be a statewide? And I can't really tell what's going to happen at this stage.
Okay, all right. And it would appear that the education minister is trying to make out that it's a problem that the executive of the AEU hasn't got control of the membership. In fact, it should be the other way around, really, isn't it? Shouldn't be the members be in control of the executive?
Yeah. I think that comes through, again, like the wording of in the press statement was that, you know, the union had reached an agreement, or the union is the whole of the membership. So I'm disappointed with those sort of comments. There should have been a respect for the democratic process of our union. As I said, we did have a fairly exhaustive process. Each sub-branch got to vote. And depending on how big the sub-branch was depending how many votes they got. And the membership did actually vote. So there should be some respect for that process. People have a right in a democracy to have a point of view that's different from the government.
Now, people should realise too that this is covering all staff at public schools, including principals, isn't it, this time?
Yeah, that's true. So we're an industry union. So we cover educational support staff, teachers and principals. So it's pretty much everyone who works in a public school can join the AEU as well. There are some people who, like, for instance, some IT technicians, psychologists, et cetera, who might be in a different union, but mostly it's those classifications.
And so your feeling is that people are in it for the long haul?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. There's a determination, I believe, for another strike. We do have 42% of the membership did vote yes, so it's going to have to be some discussion in the union about that, some respectful discussions. And I'm hopeful, I'm pretty confident we'll end up getting a better deal. I think the government will want to have an agreement with the AEU because they want to wrap this agreement up before the election, and that's really our big power at the moment. I know that the media might... There's a fear that the media might turn against us. I think that will come back to rank and file workers actually having conversations with parents in each school and explaining why we rejected the deal and why we actually need to pick schools up. Not long ago, I was in Chicago, and I talked to some people from Chicago, and there's a famous strike where the workers there said that our working conditions are your child's learning conditions. And I think that's really relevant to the situation we're in today. Schools have been underfunded in this state for a long, long time. And every member in our unions have been facing the consequences of that. So there has to be a reckoning, and it's going to take money to fix this issue up. And one part of that is making sure we've got decent conditions. The other part of it is making sure that we do have the funding to look after you talked about before, which is special needs kids, etc.
I mean, it's very important, the issues within public education for everybody in the state.
Mm. Yeah, and you also need to, this is also taken in the context of, unfortunately, both sides of government, both the Liberals and the Labor Party, have been directly subsidising private schools. As I said, I was in America a couple of weeks ago, and they were shocked when I told them that the government in Australia just gives money directly to private schools and to religious schools. It's quite outrageous, and we have 40% of secondary students actually going to a private school. So this has to stop. We need to put forward a lot of money into public education, because it's a right, it's a basis of a democratic society that you have students going to public school. But really, I just feel like it's fairly clear that, you know, if you, and this is the government's own, actually acknowledge this, but to get schools fully funded in Victoria, it's $2.4 billion. And so that needs to happen. We need to have enough funding to schools to sustain the workforce. Workload is a contributing factor to people leaving the profession. A lot of staff are experiencing burnout as well. So there has to be acknowledgement of that, and that has to be reflected in an agreement. One of the most disappointing things about the government offer, and people aren't quite aware of this, and people need to have a bit of a think about this. Someone like myself, who's a sub-branch president, sub-branch rep, I only get less than 1 hour a week in most schools, time allowance to do my job as a rep. That is to go around talking to people to get their point of view. We don't have a clear right even to have a paid meeting. We ask for 2 paid meetings a term. So how can we put up an argument, alternative argument to our employer if the union representative doesn't get adequate time to talk to members, and members don't have an adequate time to actually meet as a workforce? So that says something about the culture in schools at the moment, and that needs to change.
Yeah, they're being disingenuous, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, as I said, I'm optimistic. We'll probably have to take some fairly serious industrial action to get a better agreement. But I think a lot of members are up for that. And then the next offer that the government makes, it needs to be a lot better than the agreement or the offer that they actually tried to get us to agree to this time around. But there is going to be a rally. Keilor Downs have organised a rally outside the minister's office, which is quite exciting. And good on those members for doing that. So here it is. Here's the details.
Yep.
So a rally at Ben Carroll's office. So a fight for a better deal for school staff and fully funded schools. And that will take place July 16th. And that's going to be at 4:45 p.m. at 473 Keilor Road, Nidri. It's really important that people turn up. This is an opportunity that we have as workers and as a community to actually have a protest outside the minister's office. And that's week one. So that's a good start of the term as well.
Hello, this is Maluma May from Boolagan, and you're listening to 3CR.
A weak solidarity brickie team listener win top marks to the Reserve Losses Bank for standing up for its principles. Principles that the solution to inflation is wage restraint and higher unemployment. It's got nothing to do with the caring business class or caring business class greed. No, it's all down to the workers. Too many of them, and too many of them wanting to be paid. So good on the Reserve Losses and Supremo Michelle Bulldust for standing up against the money-grabbing greed of their lazy, avaricious workforce. So unconcerned over the economy, it claims the bank's 9.5% increase over 3 years is a real wage cut. How fiscally reckless. Their disrespect gets worse. As an organisation full of economists, management obviously knows this. The offer therefore presents a very negative view of the value staff are providing. If the organisation full of economists really cared, they would resign and join the unemployed and or take a wage cut. But no, they put themselves ahead of the need to fight inflation. Selfish, selfish economists. Worse, timely warning from prominent business class party apparatchik Prude Go Hard Against Workers, warning the caring business class party, if it does not concentrate on fighting the socialist caring business class relations laws, the coalition will, quote, condemn its business base to bankruptcy. Bankruptcy. Any wonder the filthy rich are shaking in their boots, or their Italian, Swiss and leather shoes and boots. Worse, speaking of luxury, a mob called Luxury Escape Supremo Adam Schwab told us the state's socialist work-from-home laws will drive a dagger through the heart of Victoria's sickly business community. And yes, don't the filthy rich look pretty sickly? As we've said a few times, who'd be a caring employer doing her his altruistic bit for society faced with such unrelenting perfidy? Like poor Simon Crew Work Harder grilled the workers supremo mentioned last week, despite years of accusations of ripping off workers, Simon assures us his only concern is those workers, and then charged with misleading customers in a promotion to donate to environmental causes, and now he's under attack for a harmless little ad, super buns to brag about, with a bun on a woman's backside. Staff claiming the ad is sexist for no stronger reason than the ad is 100% sexist. He's prepared to use women's bodies as a punchline to sell burgers, the evil union alleged. For goodness sake, that's his job. Even though he cares even more about the workers, as long as they don't demand conditions and pay. Also debate this week. Multiracial is a scavenging vulture threatening our cherished moron culture. Moron culture proving everything's right so long as all of us are white. Although not sure there was much of a debate, as caring business class party supremo and would-be big supremo Angus Tailings couldn't quite get his tongue around the word. Whereas one notions that appalling Hoonson knows all about moron culture. Speaking of morons, her new MP got off to a big start by voting the wrong way. Well, as it turned out, the correct way, but he got confused. Maybe the fact that the motion was in, like, words confused him, but he apologised and that appalling assured us he would vote the appalling moron way in future. As long as someone explains to him what the words mean. What a loss to the education system, the demise of the Christ Hands-On Brothers, forced to sell up to meet a percentage of the damages they owe the young men, whose biggest lesson was, don't go near them. Sworn to obey the dictates of the dear baby Jesus, their observation stopped at the dick bit. Interesting they have to sell up because they have, quote, just $23 million in the bank, they said. That simply highlights the extent of their criminality. They won't be missed, nor will Carl Stefano, voice of rubbish, after eulogising a British neo-fascist, even Channel Ning Nong forced to respond to public opprobrium. One commentator telling us, Carl is riding two horses at once. One is in the centre, another is in the far right lane. And presuming the mindless dribble offered as morning entertainment is in the centre, the mind boggles at what might be called the right. True to form, that appalling Hoonson uploaded the neo-fascist interview to her account. Shocked poor Carl could be so mistreated. Carl's journalistic balance reflected in his reference to temporary His Most Gracious Majesty's home country supremo Keir Starmer as a wanker, proving smart, intelligent, omniscient Carl is no wanker. I read where Carl's dribble, the in-the-centre morning dribble, is trailing the rival channel's morning dribble. I, and I suspect we, listener, can't believe anyone watches either of them. Then again, I saw a photo shoot of the nominees for the so-called Gold Logie and thought, to paraphrase the bard, has our talented entertainment pool shrunk to this small measure? That appalling's local hero and role model, and almost certainly ditto Carl, our filthiest rich of the filthy rich, Gina. It's just one problem after another. Any wonder her Perth offices are tired with wise, thought-provoking quotes from her hero, the filthiest rich of the filthy rich, Elon must have more. Calling for government to get out of the way and let the filthy rich do what they do best, make themselves filthy richer. Bloody government. Poor Gina's been forced to flog off one of her numerous grazing properties, 23,000 hectares for a mere 60 mil. Pocket money to Gina because the Queensland government wants to tax her. well, tax her Chinese partner a foreign tax surcharge of all of 3%. This is unsustainable from a business perspective, Gina bemoaned. Yes, how cruel interfering government, because imagine how a 3% tax surcharge must so hurt Gina, a tax surcharge she apparently can't avoid. Yes, better to pocket 60 mil than be hit with a 3% tax. And something that would also hurt her, perhaps not quite as much as it doesn't involve the hip pocket, but still hurt, abrade her faith in the troops of Aussie people. That survey that but 21% trust Gina's hero, US of the UN, of the US of the world, big supremo Donald Trump or the poor to do the right thing in world affairs. If it's any consolation to Gina and that appalling and Carl, we can guarantee Donald will always do the right thing. But worse, a majority have more faith in evil China. Not that her admiration for Donald prevents her working with her Chinese partner when there's a quid or billion involved. And further consolation, our minister for being offensive and trained killing Richard Malls the bad guys, he of the giant mind, assured us America, we assume he means the US old bit of the Americas, remains the cornerstone of our strategic and foreign policy, and the alliance has never been more important. He's so spot on, isn't he? On the other hand, we might question what the 21% who do have faith in Donald were thinking. They're probably busy watching Carl's in-depth interviews. The promised benefits of privatisation of public services, lower prices due to the efficiency of the private sector, highlighted yet again as the electricity regulator announced standing offer reductions of up to 10.7% guaranteed to lower our bills. Well, not quite. The efficiency of the private sector came to the rescue, with the poor dears forced to increase their supply charges by up to 86%. And what do we know? There go the lower bills. It must so hurt the privatised industry to find it just can't afford to pass on the price cuts. 86%, that's inflation run riot. Further proof of the greed of those reserve losses bank workers. Because the privatised utilities, efficiency, lower prices could never be accused of greed. Nor could KP on the workers MG for keep profits mega grand being attacked just because it used in-confidence information from clients to make a killing and made a whistleblower's life so miserable he says he would never do it again. Surely keep profits mega is just doing what it exists to do, make profits mega. It may face some severe penalties like a temporary pause, say 3 or 4 days, in those multi-billion outsourcing it enjoys from the public purse, allowing it too to bring the efficiency of the private sector to the bloated inefficient hand of the public sector. Speaking of efficiency, the Mineral Profits Council's Tania Constable Profits attacked noisy activists who would seek to diminish industries like the mining industry and regional True Blue Aussie. After the anti-True Blue Aussie spoilsport True Blue Aussie Institute warned of dodgy carbon offsetting, as if there's something dodgy about planting a tree somewhere and polluting to your big heart's content. The efficiency of the offset system proven by a shell-out-the-profits gas facility in Western True Blue Aussie earning more than $90 million in carbon credits, real figure, while increasing its emissions by 400,000 tonnes, real figure. To prove its credentials, Shell said it supports measures for True Blue Aussie to be a net zero economy. Little measures like 90 mil in the kick and 400,000 tonnes on Mother Earth. Finally, Tania was in Canberra launching a hands-off fuel campaign aimed at preventing the government touching the industry's fuel tax rebate, which costs the public purse a mere $13 billion a year. A small price for Mother Earth to pay. Good morning.
Hi, we're from Braybrook College and you're listening to 3CR Community Radio.
On 8:55 a.m.
And we're coming to the end of Solidarity Breakfast. Thanks very much, Kevin, for a great roundup of all the suspicious behaviour coming from the big end of town. We're going to end up with another piece of skullduggery from the working class standing on the streets a week ago. This was the ASU council rally, and this is why it thought it was important to give you a bit of a coverage of this, because if you're listening to this in Melbourne or any place in Victoria, the council workers haven't been paid a reasonable rate for about a decade, and they're rope bull, and this will affect the services in your area. Because they really need something to happen. And this is some of the voices from that rally. Can you tell me why the council workers are on strike today?
Because we want better pay.
Yeah, why
better
is it?
Conditions.
Better conditions.
Better working conditions.
Yes.
Yeah, what's going on in your workplace? Where do you work?
City of Greater Dandenong. We have been asking for a pay rise and it haven't happened. And with the cost of living now, it's, you know, everything has gone up. And that's why we are fighting for, you know, fair.
Have you ever been on strike before?
No, it's my first. I thought it's something that we should all stick together and do the right thing.
And how long have you been working for the council then?
Over 20 odd years.
Rally is in Melbourne, but it's actually affecting right across Victoria, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Local government going backwards over the years. You know, rate capping is, you know, crippled wage increases. You know, some councils have only got 1.5%, like Yarra, for example. Yeah, just going backwards. So, yeah, they're not bargaining in good faith, we believe. So we've gone from single. We've been doing single agreements for 30 years and getting nowhere. So we're now we've got multi. So we've got eight councils in this group to get the ball rolling. Then as other councils come out of expiry, we rope them in. Yeah, no, I've been involved with local government 35 years, and the last rally was the first rally that I've been involved with for local government, and it was really good, very empowering.
You're the delegate for Darabin Council.
I am.
One of the delegates. Can you tell me about the experience of getting people to be on side for this stop work?
Yeah, well, I'm out at Bundura Park Farm, and we've been there for 33 years. We've never closed our doors. This is the first time the whole farm and the park areas close their doors to attend here. So that's how much it's affecting the staff out there now. Most staff there are casuals, a lot of them, and they won't even put them permanent part-time. They're always coming up with excuses all the time. And these staff, you know, they're young people that want to get mortgages and do things in their lives. So it's quite a sad situation. Councils, I've worked in councils for nearly 40 years and I've never seen it going down so quickly. They're all going down here. They're selling off all their properties and everything to try and keep afloat. I went to a management meeting the other week and I just looked at them when I was trying to put a point across, and they reminded me of blinking deers looking at headlights at night. They just blink, blink, blink. They're not interested. They don't care about us mushrooms. And yet it's us that has the compassion. We're all the ones that do the hard work with the ratepayers and the communities. They're just up there trying to make themselves look good. They're on a contract. They have to prove themselves on that contract or they're out the door. So they don't care about us people. They really don't.
So what you're really saying is that when you come to public services, people need to support the council workers because it's in their interest.
It is. It's, you know, we're there, the small people, doing all the community work, not management. You won't see management going down into family counselling or anything to do with the communities. They're up there trying to balance the budget, but they always seem to balance it in their favour. I couldn't tell you the last time at Bundura Park Farm, we've had top management come down and see how much work needs to be done there. It's a beautiful farm. It gets so many people in, families, you know, and it just, even people who've got health issues, mental health issues, they come there, they sit with the animals and you see them leaving. They're happy. They're a lot happier. I mean, we need money injected there because all our fences are falling down and the staff, the farm staff, they have to try and rebuild fences out of old wooden. It's incredible what we have to. We can't even buy pens in the stationery cupboard. It's ridiculous how it's getting. It's really ridiculous how it's getting now.
My name's Luke, and I'm a City of Melbourne librarian and ASU delegate. I've been a bargaining rep at Melbourne for the last 15 years, and I wanted to get up today and congratulate you all for your amazing work and solidarity, and for showing out in force not once but twice. You're all doing an amazing job and you should be really, really proud. I was really pleased to learn this morning that we'd actually be rallying outside this very significant monument. Every time I pass it with my kids, I tell them the story of how the eight-hour day was won and fought for in Melbourne and how it then spread to the rest of the world. Last time we marched past here in May, I even saw tourists underneath here hearing the story of the eight-hour day and how it was won as we were marching past. And I felt really proud that we're marching in the same spirit and for something equally fundamental, fair pay for our work. This is actually the fourth time I've bargained for a collective agreement, and even though I know things might seem to be moving slowly, I can guarantee you we're already streets ahead of where we would have been if we were bargaining under single enterprise agreements. This time, the council can't just stonewall us because they require union endorsement to put an agreement out to vote. This time, the councils are scared of our action because there's so many of us and we're showing them that here today. This time, our collective bargaining power has already resulted in an interim 2.5% increase that we would never have achieved without MEB. And if you think that this is big, just think about the future. In 4 years' time and beyond, when it's every council out here demanding better pay. Now, of course, some things remain the same. Council CEOs will receive hundreds of thousands of dollars in salaries, and then with a straight shame, and then with a straight face, turn around and tell you that a cost of living wage increase for you is too expensive. They'll continue to blame the rate cap and expect you to subsidise it for everybody else. And they'll continue to deliberately delay and drag things out, hoping that you'll just give up. But today shows you're not going to give up, and you'll keep fighting the good fight because it's absolutely working. What we want isn't too difficult for anyone to understand. We want fair pay, we want it now, and we're going to fight for it. Thanks a lot.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Stu Moisey. I'm a delegate from Maribyrnong and I look after the events participation. First off, I wanted to acknowledge and congratulate my comrades in the community centres and the libraries for turning up and being here today. You are some of the most vulnerable workers as casuals, and it's so important that you're here today. So thank you for showing up and showing what's important. Also, we've got our colleagues in the early years team for shutting down the supporter playgroup. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And everyone else from Maribyrnong, well done on turning up. Amazing. Like me, none of us want to be here today. Like me, they would rather be doing the work that they love in the community that they love. But they understand the importance of being here and standing up for what is right. A fair pay deal for all workers across all councils. When I made the decision to move into local government, it was because I wanted to give back to the community in which I live. My role is community facing, and every day I see the impact that our work has on the lives of local people in Maribyrnong. Whether it's arranging free pool and gym access for survivors of family violence, helping develop programs to teach new migrants how to swim, or simply supporting the day-to-day operations that keep our local services running, it has always been rewarding work. However, feeling good about the work you do does not put food on the table and it doesn't put a roof over your head. As real wages continue to fall behind the cost of living, I've had to face the reality and take on additional work just to make ends meet. With our wages going backwards, I could no longer afford to live in the city of Maribyrnong. Council work used to mean fair work for fair pay. Today we're seeing that principle slip away further and further as more staff are pushed onto temporary contracts, casual roles, and like myself, working two or sometimes three jobs to get by. This should not be normal. Even now working 50 to 60 hours a week, I'm still faced with a choice that previous generations of Maribyrnong and council workers did not have to face. Do I buy a place to live in and put a roof over my head, or do I start a family? I've done the numbers, and with the cost of living where it is and our wages where they are, I can only choose one. That is the reality facing me and so many other workers across councils. This is not normal. Today's situation stands in stark contrast to the experience of previous generations of workers, like my colleague Kay in libraries. She began her career at Maribyrnong Library, and on her wage she was able to raise two children and put a roof over their heads. For many young people working in local government, this is not a realistic prospect. Additionally, throughout this process, we've been repeatedly told that we should work with management in good faith. Yet each day I come into the office, I see union posters have disappeared and all staff emails that directly criticise our union representatives. At the bargaining table, I've seen painfully slow approach to negotiations, which has been designed to wear us down. It will not wear us down. For management and those CEOs on hundreds of thousands of dollars, this may be a game. But while they delay and play their tactics, our wages continue to go backwards. Every day that inflation rises and wages fail to keep pace, workers are forced to pick up extra shift, take on that extra job, or work longer hours just to afford the basics. The fight we are undertaking today and why we're here today, it's not about greed. We just want a fair wage that keeps pace with the cost of living and allows workers to live with dignity. This is not an unreasonable demand, and it's the minimum that everyone deserves. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure to introduce Mel Van Dyke from Yarra City Council.
First and foremost, I also wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we are meeting today. To all of the council workers joining us from City of Greater Dandenong, Merribeck, Darabin, City of Melbourne, Hume, Hobsons Bay, Maribyrnong, even Windham, and of course my beloved comrades at Yarra City, and a shout out to our most vulnerable casual workers in taking time, all of us, to join us today. I truly value each and every one of your time and contribution to our cause, the sacrifices that you have made to join us today and all along the way to get to this point. My name is Mel Van Dyke. I'm an ASU delegate, a Yarra City Council worker, a Yarra City Council resident, and some may say fortunate enough to be a ratepayer of Yarra City Council. Although the way things are going, I don't know how much longer I'm going to be able to hold that title. I have worked in and out of local government for the last 18 years in a range of roles in areas varying from school crossing supervisor, yes, I was a lollipop lady, road and community safety, community grants, and most recently within the Office of the Mayor and Councillors. Never have I ever seen such severe wage decline and cost of living pressures for local government workers as I have seen in this last almost decade. Over the last four or so years alone, also known as the most of our Metro MEB Council's enterprise bargaining agreement periods, I have watched our real wages change and compared with CPI in a state of disarray. Yarra City Council's real wage change, and thanks Dylan at Melbourne for your wonderful stats and data, the real wage change at Yarra City Council is minus 13.9%. Hobsons Bay is minus 13.2%. And wait for it, City of Melbourne, frequently proudly claimed as one of our most livable cities in the world, no doubt thanks to the local government workers that are present here today, is minus 14.6%. Shame! It's no coincidence that the Victorian rate cap that was introduced in 2016 has played a huge part in this wage decline problem for our local government workers. Every council worker here today has heard the excuse of their CEOs, their executive leadership, consistently blaming the rate cap for a lack of a fair wage increase. Even though none of these Metro MEB councils have ever applied for an increase exemption since its inception, but that's shameful, and that's another story, I don't want to keep you too long. Yet many have consistently paid their workers even less than the said rate cap. The total rate cap percentage between the four financial years of 21 to 25 was 9.5%. Meanwhile, Yarra City Council paid their workers a total of 7.1% over 4 years. City of Melbourne gave just 7% over 4 years. And congratulations to the leadership of Hobson's Bay, giving their workers a measly 6% over 4 years. Shame! Local government workers, our gut-busting garbos, our home care workers, well, what's left of them after the service reviews, our early childhood educators, leisure centre staff, our librarians, our lollipop people, our frontline public service workers, the people that literally clean the shit off of our streets, keeping us safe, well, healthy and our cities functioning, we're frequently told how important we are, how valuable we are. That our community, our employers, our government leaders appreciate and value us. Yet we're shoved to the back of the line when it comes to budget time. Yeah. Our state government claim that many councils are in financial surplus. Yarra City Council just adopted their highest capital works budget ever last night. And yet we still hear every decision maker crying poor. Well, local government workers have had enough of being taken advantage of being fobbed off and pushed to the back of the line for a piece of the pie. And we will not stand idly by, struggling financially, watching our colleagues and comrades suffer while Jacinta Allen, the state government, the CEOs, the mayor and councillors, and I know some of you are here today, but you are also part of these decision makers. We watch you all pass the buck. Well, there's no more excuses. It's time to scrap the cap, and we want fair pay, and we want it now.
And they do. They want it now. And you've got an announcement to make, Matt.
Yes, there's a Yusufa Rumawi, who we all know from Palestine Remembered, and also he's leading the Taraba Ensemble. He's restarting his series of Understanding Palestine lectures. This is number 45. It will be on this Wednesday evening at 6:30 at Democracy House, which is at 583 High Street, Northcote. Entry is by donation, and there'll be an opportunity to have a Palestinian meal provided by his wife, Wissam. So I highly recommend going. I've been going to most of them, and the theme of the talk this week will be on prisoners, the Palestinian prisoners, which you spoke about last week on his program.
Okay, and that's it, a wrap for Solidarity Breakfast. Coming up next is Asia Pacific Current.
Listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.